is remarkable. He comes up towards the winning line under Davy Russell to win his second Randox Health Grand National.
Desert Orchid, watch history being made. Roars of applause. The king's in his county.
Heading down towards the last ride in the champion hurdle, and it's Annie Power comes towards it now. She's about four lengths clear. Viziosi jumped it perfectly.
You're very welcome along to another episode of From the Horse's Mouth. On this week's show, I'm joined as ever by Paddy and Ruby, who rejoice at racing's comeback in the UK. Leading jockey William Buick is on the line to talk about Pinatubo and life on Team Godolphin. Frank Hickey makes his triumphant return. He has horses for the tracker and winners galore. All that and more straight from the horse's mouth. Welcome back, everybody. And yes, we have arrived. UK racing is back on Monday. We think, Ruby?
You think, yeah. I mean, Boris Johnson didn't say it was or it wasn't, because he didn't mention sport or horse racing in his speech on Thursday night. And as of when we started recording anyway, Tom, on Friday morning, there has been no absolute confirmation. I mean, Brant Dunshay kind of led us to believe it was a done deal last Sunday, but who knows what can happen in a week in the government. But it still hasn't been absolutely given the go ahead yet.
What price are we to go ahead, Paddy? It must be fairly short for racing to go ahead at this stage.
It was 1-10 last night anyway, I looked.
A lot of people obviously mad keen to get a run into some of their flat horses entries over Monday and Kempton on Wednesday, in excess of 500. So a lot of people itching to get out and get running.
Yeah, it's mad. And I'm just reading while we're talking here, some of the comments and the quotes about it. Like, so Boris Johnson said changes will be limited and cautious. But then the view in the Racing Post is that racing seemed to pass a significant hurdle on Thursday as Prime Minister Johnson announced the government was easing its lockdown measures. So Ruby's right. It's kind of a little bit counting our chickens, but let's just presume it's happening on Monday, okay? Let's be optimistic about it.
You sounded surprised there, Paddy.
What?
That I might actually be right.
Well, no, I wouldn't be surprised that you're right, but I'm certainly not surprised that you're looking the glass half empty.
Oh, I'm not. I'm being realistic. I would like to see that box ticked, because
I know.
It's ticked, there's no racing.
Right. Well, it is looking relatively positive, but I think even just it's hard to contain the excitement, because we've got back-to-back guineas and straight into Royal Ascot, Paddy. It's going to be a busy couple of weeks, and it's great to be talking about these good flat horses again, isn't it?
It's great. We've got the champagne on order now coming in for Ascot week. We'd have the Royal Ascot in the garden. I think that June is going to be one to remember. It's going to be one for the memories, because at this stage, usually you have kind of a bit of a wait for between the big meetings, and like same as before Cheltenham or some of that, there's always a lull in top quality before one of the big meetings happens. But in June, it's all been squished together. So I think it's going to be one of the greatest tunes ever.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I never thought that I would be looking forward to an all weather meeting on a Monday afternoon in Newcastle, but like I am. But having said that, Newcastle is the start. It's further forward. I'm looking, like Paddy, it's next weekend. It's Newmarket, the Coronation Cup on Friday, the Guineas Saturday, Sunday, and then on to Naas on Monday, and you know the Irish Guineas the following weekend, and then you're straight into Royal Ascot. Because so much is going to come at us so thick and so fast, there's going to be lots of individual winners, and there's going to be some great clashes going forward into the future. And even sitting here now today, Tom, looking at it, I mean, you could run the first four classics in England and Ireland without an Aidan O'Brien winner.
That's right. But obviously one horse has been dominating the headlines, not least because he came out for a trot around Chelmsford on Thursday, 10 days before he heads to Newmarket for the 2,000 guineas as odds on favourite. It's a great pleasure to be able to welcome the man who will be riding him in that race, having been his regular pilot throughout his two-year-old season, barring his own injury. That is, of course, William Buick. William, how are you?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much for joining us. First and foremost, I suppose, how have you been looking after yourself? Have you been staying safe, staying out of trouble, and most importantly, I suppose, keeping fit and well?
Yeah, no, I mean, first of all, you know, thank God we've been staying healthy, and, you know, everyone been staying well, and obviously, you know, obeying the guidelines. As for myself, needless to say, I've been riding out more now than what I usually would, especially this time of the year. Which has been quite enjoyable to get in all the horses, and obviously as a substitute to race riding, you try and get as fit as possible in the gym. So I have a little setup at home that I've been sort of using the gym there quite regularly every day.
The obvious thing is, William, every jockey is going to be on the same level playing field as such. I mean, they're all going to be as fit as each other. So there's not really going to be an advantage or a disadvantage for anybody, is there?
No, I don't think so, really. And I think, look, I suppose in anything, in any sport, really, you get the select few that would obviously push themselves a little bit more, as you well know, like you did when you were riding, obviously, had that extra focus and pushed yourself that bit further. And I suppose you've got a few of the lads that will have done that and got themselves in the zone. But as a whole, I think, yeah, it's the same for everybody. Everybody's starting the season, if you like, from scratch in this country. So, yeah, it's a level playing field.
I always found that a good horse gave me something to inspire me or make me focus that bit harder. And you've had all winter to look forward to Pinatubo. It should have been in May. It's coming in June. But I bet you can't wait to head down the Rolly Mile on him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, it's, you know, he was foot perfect last year, and you know, it's all been said about him before. You know, he had a long season last year, but he performed every run, obviously he's wintered well. He looks fantastic, and yeah, he's a horse that we're all very much looking forward to.
It's great to have a horse like him that doesn't seem to have any quirks, or it doesn't matter what way the race will be run for you. He looks so straightforward. His temperament. He showed in Newmarket that he can battle. He showed in the Curragh that he has gears. He showed in Epsom that he's able to handle undulations. He just seems so straightforward.
Yeah, no, you're right. He is. And he's very versatile with it as well. Like you said, you know, he obviously ran at Epsom Goodwood, travelled over to the Curragh, ran in Newmarket at the back end on soft ground. And his temperament as well, it's a huge, huge help. And he's always took everything in his stride, which, as we all know from a jockey's point of view, it's a dream.
And would there be, I know everyone's on a level playing field here, not having a practice run, but would you have liked to get a prep run into him, or would he be always be going straight there?
Well, to be honest, I don't think Charlie ever thought about giving a prep run, whatever was going to happen. Obviously, no one could foresee this happening halfway through the winter, I suppose, but I don't think that was ever on the radar, but obviously that would have been Charlie's call. It's kind of irrelevant now. Everyone is going to turn up a Newmarket without a prep run. So, you know, Pinatubo himself, he's had a little race course gallop, and his work's been good. So he's prepping very well.
Obviously for yourself, William, last year was a bit, I suppose, for a flat jockey, strange in that you had a head injury and you spent quite a bit of time on the sidelines. I know how difficult it is to watch on and look and watch horses you should be riding winning. How did you find watching him? He must have been so hard to watch in Ascot.
I mean, it's hard to stand on the sidelines and you feel a bit...
You like feel him. Like a spare.
you do a little bit. But also, I think, you know, I also felt, you know, last year when obviously he won at Ascot, and Blue Point won at Ascot as well. And the big meetings like that, when you have the nice horses, that's when you really push yourself when you're on the sidelines, because, you know, you come back home and you just, you know, all you want to do is get back and get on these horses, and you know, you even try and get back better than what you were before, and that's kind of the mindset I had towards it all. But yeah, look, it was a tough time, but I had great support around me from Sheikh Mohammed and from Charlie, which gives you just that bit of, you know, kind of comfort, but just gives you that bit of security, and you know, you got something to look forward to when you do eventually come back.
William, I wanted to talk to you a little bit. You mentioned Sheikh Mohammed there, and I wanted to talk about maybe you and the Godolphin job. And you've been around a long time, champion apprentice, and you're not new to the Godolphin role, but maybe for people who wouldn't know, was there a much added pressure taking on that job? What main differences were there, say, for the likes of when you were riding for John Gosden? And how does your kind of day-to-day routine differ now that you're working for Godolphin?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a great job. You know, working with great people, working with great horses. And, you know, we have a great boss at the top of it. But of course, you know, in these big jobs, there's always pressure to perform. You know, at the end of the day, it's a results-based sport. So, you know, you need to be winning races. You need to be winning the right races, the important races, and I suppose a big operation like that, you know, you need to produce stallions as well. So, but no, it's a great job. I enjoy a lot of aspects of it. Obviously, riding nice horses on a daily basis, and also sort of the global aspect of it as well, being able to travel the world and participate in some of the great races around the world as well.
That's something I missed as a jump jockey. You didn't get to travel the world. It was you know, jumping is so small compared to the flat. But if you were, if I said to you, William Buick, you have to go and ride somewhere else in the world, would you go to America? Would you go to Australia, Japan? Where would you go if you had to move?
Oh, that'd be tough. I mean, I've spent quite a lot of winters in Japan, and that's sort of my, I sort of have 6 weeks there, November, December, kind of every year. I try to incorporate that into my season. And it's a great place, great racing, huge betting turnover, and they produce some great horses as well. And I mean, I've also spent a couple of winters when I was an apprentice, spent a couple of winters in America as well, which I enjoyed. It's great. Obviously, the Breeders' Cup is the meeting that we would probably target the most, but it's I've spent a little bit of time in Australia as well, ridden in the Melbourne Cup a handful of times, never really had any luck. Yeah, it's a great way of life down there, and the racing is very well organised, and they get huge public support as well. It's a very sporting nation, and the nation really gets behind the racing, and especially races like the Melbourne Cup. I mean, if I had to pick one country to answer your question, I think it's a hard one, but all three of those countries have fantastic racing. The only problem would be in Japan is the lightweights.
And the language.
And the language, yeah.
William, Charlie had a nice quote last year as well called, I can't really pronounce it, Boccaccio.
Oh, yeah, he
won in Yarmouth and Kempton. How's he?
Yeah, he's good. He looks fantastic. He looks like he's wintered well. From what I've seen, he looks like he's stepping up his work. I'm not exactly sure what the plan is with him, but he looks well. He's done well, and I thought he was good last year. I thought he did well when he won at Kempton, and he looked also nice when he won first time at Yarmouth. So he's a very well-bred horse who looks the part as well.
Well, William Buick, you're a gentleman. Thank you very much for joining us. Best of luck with Pinatubo, and best of luck for the season. Thank you.
Thank you very much, guys. Pleasure.
Well, that was William Buick, but now it's time to move on. Well, we didn't ask him any stupid questions. We saved those for Paddy Power's stupid questions. Paddy, take it away.
Yes, thank you very much, Tom. This is the part of the show where I can pretend that people actually ask these questions that I actually have to want to try and get the answer to. Been involved in racing for, I suppose, 45 now, so I guess for about 45 years, and still some things I don't understand, so I just use people, random Twitter names. People have been very good on Twitter, sending in lots of some stupid, some decent questions, so please do, because anyone who's we use is going to get some sort of prize or other, aren't they, Tom? You're the boss.
That is correct, yes.
Yeah, grand. Okay, so the first one I'm going to go at Ruby this week is Ash Henk Rian. Says, do stable jockeys really get to choose their rides, or does their trainer force their hand?
It depends, different times. And everybody has a different relationship with their trainer or their boss. I always actually had a free hand to ride whichever one I chose. And therefore, when they were wrong, it was your own decision. Some jockeys will actually prefer to have the trainer make that decision so they won't be wrong themselves. But theoretically, yeah. Jockeys also would seek the advice of the trainer, though, Paddy. I mean, the trainer is training the horse, and they probably know more about the horse than the jockey, so it would always be done in consultation.
And did you ever, like, stick your heels in and be wrong?
I worked with Willie, and Willie would want you to ride the horse that you wanted to ride more so than the one that he wanted you to ride. He wanted you to be happy on the horse you were on, so that's the way he let it be. And Paul was pretty much the same. Paul Nichols, obviously, I didn't ride out as much as Paul Nichols, so I was more led by him as to which one he taught, but usually you make the decision yourself.
Okay. I'm guessing the answer to the next one is obvious, but just in case it's not, I'm going to ask it anyway. At Swad Lad asks, why is the 2000 guineas called the 2000 guineas?
I'm assuming it was worth 2000 guineas and it was first run, but other than that, I'm guessing history is not my strongest point. If either of you have a better answer to that one, lads,
But they still talk about a horse cost a certain amount of guineas, like these days.
Yeah, well, the guinea was the, say a pound is a pound, and a guinea was the percentage on top of it. It was 5 pence originally. So a guinea was 1 pound and 5 pence, and the guinea was the sales company's commission. So that's what a guinea is.
There you go. Now, that's a bit of information I didn't know. But why do we still, or why do some people still, is that just a weird British thing?
No, I think that was pretty much world-renowned in horse terms, guineas. You bought horses in guineas pretty much all around the world. There was a commission added on.
Jeez, that's gas. The commission's...
That's still used as far as I know. I don't buy many horses in public auctions, but I think that's still used.
Okay. And the last one I'll ask you for now is from @ATSNFLNBA. Oh, yeah, maybe it's NFL and NBA or whatever. At the, this person who know who they are. Is there a collection of people who decide a horse's handicap, or is it calculated by algorithms?
Collection of people. Handicappers are real-life people, and they are few people working for the establishment like the IHRB or the BHA that actually get to use their own opinion, because handicapping is only an opinion. And there's a whole team of them in the UK because there's so much racing. In Ireland, for the jump racing, there's two handicappers, Sandy Shaw and Shea Quinn. And there's two on the flat, but they watch all the racing and they make the decisions as to what rating a horse should have. Now, they may use algorithms themselves, but the actual allotment of the mark is given by them.
And funny, the other question on that is, because I'm always a little bit surprised and wondering about the strategies, and you hear Michael O'Leary every year saying, Tiger O's not going to run in the national because he's got too much weight and all that kind of stuff. And trainers, the odd times, actually, we've got no chance, the handicappers after killing us, and they give out, stink about the handicapper. Is that a calculated risk? I mean, if you were a trainer, would you put up and shut up, or would you have a moan? Because the handicapper's never really going to change his mind, is he?
No, he won't.
Really?
No, the handicappers don't change their opinion, and it is only their opinion. And they all use different ways of doing it. Look, I have, of course, they can be right and they can be wrong. Their objective is to try and get every horse to finish in a line, which is nigh on impossible. But I do firmly believe that if you're going to give a horse a £10 penalty for winning, you should be able to drop him down quicker than they do. Horses can rise up the ratings very quickly, but it takes forever and an age to come back down the ratings. And I think, Paddy, simply, when a handicapper looks at horses that finish 15th, 16th and 17th, the idea is to bring them all closer together, yet they only ever put up one end and very rarely drop the other. And they don't drop it anywhere near the same rate.
But that's an inherent distrust, isn't it, in human nature, thinking, they'll try and pull the wool over my eyes by finishing down the field and all that kind of stuff.
Maybe they do, but I mean, you can build a reputation for that, and that would be fixed into the handicap assessment and penalty-wise as well.
Right. I'm happy, Tom. That's enough stupid questions for this week.
Can you actually ask a stupid question in future, not ones I have to really think about and I have to give concise answers to? Can they actually be stupid questions?
Don't worry, Ruby, those answers weren't concise.
Well, can I make a point here?
Like, there's no concise way of explaining them, Tom, sorry.
Just to reiterate why we're doing this section, right? Because while we were talking to William Buick, I asked him one question. Even as I asked, would Pinatubo like to prep run? And he kind of answered as if, why would he want to prep run? And I was thinking, like, does anyone have a prep run for the guineas? And I couldn't remember for a minute. Now, I know you could have a prep run in theory, but as I was asking, even me, who has 45 years experience in racing, still got a bit nervous that it was a stupid question. Because that's the whole point of this, because racing is a bit intimidating with all the terms. You don't want to sound like the one feckin' age in the room who doesn't know what they're talking about.
No, but you shouldn't be afraid to be the one person that doesn't know what you're talking about, because racing does have so many terms and phrases and things like that that even people in racing don't fully understand. But yeah, like asking William Buick would he have preferred a prep run for Pinatubo was a fairly legitimate question. There was nothing stupid about that one.
Two for the price of one on Racing Gold this week. Newcastle's big money flat race is the Northumberland Plate, a handicap run over an extended 2 miles, while its most high-profile hurdle race is the Fighting Fifth, a regular stepping stone for champion hurdle contenders. Overturn joined the Donald McCain Yard in 2010 and won them both inside 18 months.
Overturn approaches the final furlong with a two-length lead over Desert Sea as they race up towards the line, and it's Overturn and Eddie Ahern. He's made all the running. A tremendous performance for Plate Glory. Overturn in front by a couple of lengths to Binocular in second, who's trying to respond, but Overturn's digging in off the front and he's riding a power pack finish, Jason Maguire, and Overturn has won the Fighting Fifth. Binocular in second, Celestial Halo finished.
He had some pretty decent handicap success in the flat for Walter Swinburne. He won the Scottish Champion Hurdle at the Chester Cup too, and he was a runner-up twice at the Cheltenham Festival, over 600 grand in prize money. Ruby,
we head to Newcastle on Monday for UK Racing's return, and he is indeed a Geordie legend, probably.
Oh, he is that. And he had the ability, Tom, to go an unbelievable gallop. I mean, he came from winning that Northumberland Pay to Newcastle. His next start was in the Galway Hurdle, where he made every yard under Graham Lee and absolutely just galloped horses into the ground. He had a hugely high cruising speed, and that's what made him so hard to peg back, and he could maintain it for 2 miles. He was a grade one winner. He was just about a grade one horse, but he was. And he was a hard horse to peg back when he got rolling.
Willie has a good association with not being afraid to try horses in both codes, and has had some decent success over the years, Ruby, hasn't he?
Yeah, but a lot of them, Tom, would originally have come from off the flat and then gone jumping, and they go back on the flat with them. So they were originally flat horses that didn't quite make the top level, that were sold. Some would have been sold. A lot of flat horses are sold at the end of their three-year-old career from Great Britain and Ireland, and they go to all parts of the world. Some of them end up staying on these islands and go jumping. And, you know, Overturn was one of those that had been on the flat, went to Donald McCain. He won with him over Jumps, won with him on the flat. And Willie does the same thing. I mean, a lot of Willie's Royal Ascot winners, Cesara, which winners, were all horses bought from flat yards in Ireland, England or France that Willie went jumping with and then went back on the flat.
Wicklow Brave, of course, being one of the most high-profile, classic-winning Wicklow Brave.
Yeah, but he was the opposite. He won three bumpers for Willie. Patrick won on him. So he went the National Hunt route and then eventually went down the flat route, whereas, and won a classic, won the St. Ledger, whereas the likes of Clondalk Warrior, he was, again, had been in running bumpers, but had won on the flat for the Shark Hanlon. Lone Son, Uradel, Great White Shark winning in Galway last year. What else did Willie win in Ascot with? Peak Sue was an ex-jump horse, but he's done it with both. But Simenon, you know, even True Self, you know, Willie's not afraid to mix it.
So, Ru, would you say just being a good trainer is just being a good trainer, jumps or flat? Like, so obviously, I'm guessing, I don't know, but you'd have to train Peak Sue differently for Ascot than he would for, I don't know, Punchestown or whatever.
They are long distance races, though, Paddy. Not really. I think that's why you see that the Ascot Stakes, you see it in the Queen Alexander and Ascot as well. They're 2.5 miles, 2 miles, and 6 furlongs. That a lot of jump trainers have success in those races. Obviously, the further you go, it's a different level of fitness and a different type of fitness. And I think it's easiest to equate it to athletes. If you look or think about short distance runners on the track, like 100 or 200 meters or 800 meter runners, they're much stronger and more muscular than your distance runners. And that's the easiest way of equating flat racing with jump horses. Flat horses can often be more muscular and look heavier than jump horses, where jump horses look leaner and lighter because they're going over an extended trip.
In terms of dual purpose horses in the here and now, Goshen could be one of those, Ruby, couldn't he?
He could. I don't know. Is Gary Moore having been training for a flat campaign? But he most certainly could be. There's no doubt about that. He was going to win a Triumph Hurdle a long way. But I would think that they would train him as a jumper for the time being, Tom, and probably stick to hurdles to see if he's a champion hurdle horse before going back on the flat.
You're listening to From the Horse's Mouth by Paddy Power.
The Book Club, the penultimate installment of the From the Horse's Mouth Book Club. Paddy, I'm sure that's music to your ears. The end is in sight, despite the fact that it's a compelling read by our good friend. Chapters 14 and 15, embarking on the voyage that is parenthood, and a good story about Katie riding a couple of winners in Cheltenham, and himself and Paul Carberry as Nina and Katie came up the straight together. Ruby and Paul kind of shouting and roaring at each other in the weigh room as they watched on the television.
I've heard you say before, Ruby, it was nearly as good. And you finished second to Katie before, didn't you, Cheltenham? And it's nearly as good seeing her win, because she'd have far less opportunity and you're just literally buzzing for her. Like.
No, definitely. I don't think I ever finished second to her in Cheltenham. I rode in the county hurdle that she won. I was in hospital when she won the bumper, and I was sitting beside Paul Carberry when Poker de Savola beat Nina Carberry. So, I did. I must say, I was nervous always watching Katie, right? Nervous for her. I wouldn't say, hey, I didn't. I loved watching her riding, but I was always nervous for her, and I was definitely delighted for her when things went right that year in Cheltenham, when she rode the two winners, when she won the bumper and relegate. It was brilliant for her.
And funny, you talked about the race a little bit, the Poker de Savona race, I think it was, where she'd asked you your advice beforehand, and you said something you said to me years ago about the amateur rider races at Cheltenham, that everyone just gets too excited and goes too early and tries to make up their ground going down the hill and all that kind of stuff. And this, you said that she'd said that to her in the book, and that she just held on to and then had enough at the end. And that's just a tactic you've obviously always had in your, and always used, and the pros obviously know it, but the amateurs...
I think so, but I think Cheltenham is such an undulating track that it is so easy to get sucked into committing too soon, especially when you turn with sort of 6 furlongs to run at the top of the hill. People are getting competitive, and with the downhill, with the natural momentum that builds, people can't just get carried away with themselves, and you almost have to talk to yourself to resist that temptation, because if you run down, you've nothing left to run back up, so you have to keep a bit. But Katie would always ask questions, always seek your opinion, and she was very clever in how she carried out whatever advice she sucked from you. But yeah, I was delighted for her with Poker de Savona win one, and then obviously Thousand Stars won the county hurdle a couple of days later. It was a magic time for her, and she got the rewards that her, I think, dedication and commitment deserved.
You go on later in the chapter to specifically say, "I will train at some point." Is that still the case? Or was that just youthful exuberance?
Youthful exuberance. And you should never say never. And I'm not saying I will never train, but training right now, it didn't appeal to me the last couple of years I was riding. It didn't appeal to me when I retired. And I am fairly happy after 13 weeks in lockdown. I'm not looking out across the yard at a barn full of horses wondering, where am I going to run them? Are people going to still pay for them? Will they get the opportunities? Will tracks water ground enough? I think it's going to be a very difficult climate for racehorse trainers at the moment. I mean, if you're to believe all the economists that we're facing into an epic recession, racehorses cost money. Racehorses need wealthy people to invest in them to sustain it. And a racehorse is a hobby for most people, and hobbies usually get cut in recession, so it could be a tough time for a lot of trainers.
Paddy, I don't know if you remember this, but Ruby had a couple of back-to-back quite bad injuries, and I was very interested when you spoke about, and maybe this changed again, it was a youthful exuberance at the time, you kind of mellowed out as the years went on, but you spoke about kind of when you missed the week of Punchestown, finding it quite difficult to watch and maybe even kind of be happy watching other people win big races. Was there a little bit of maybe, I don't want to use bitterness, but that's unfair, but maybe just you found it very, very just difficult to watch as somebody else rode winners that you should have potentially been on at the time?
And that never changed, Tom, to be brutally honest. The competitor in you, that was always there. And it was always hard to watch somebody else having the success that you thought you should be having. And I've always said it, the physical side of injury went away. The pain was gone after a day, 2 days, whatever it was, painkillers, a bone starts to heal. But the mental pain of watching, you heard William Buick talking about it earlier, watching Pinatubo and how that spurred him to get back. It wasn't the excitement of trying to get back. It was to make sure he got back, got on him, and nobody else was riding him. That's the competitor that's in most sports people that are successful. And that never got easy. And I remember watching Paul Townend winning the Owl Hennessy on Total Recall, and I'd broken my leg. That's only 2 years ago or 3 years ago. Gillian was gone somewhere with the kids, and I was stomping around the kitchen on crutches. So I'd said, had enough of that. So it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon or whatever, and I opened a bottle of red wine in the kitchen, and I poured myself a glass at the counter. But now the bottle of wine open and the glass poured, and I've no way of getting it from the counter to the couch. I've 2 crutches, a glass full of wine and an open bottle, and I'm standing in the kitchen. I ended up laughing at myself after a few minutes because I couldn't, how was I going to get from A to B? I had to go on the crutches, but I couldn't carry anything on the crutches. So the wine was left on the counter and I had to hop back to the couch. Oh, I did, that's a lie. I drank the glass of wine at the counter.
But propped
up at the bar, but I couldn't bring it down to sit on the couch. So no, then the answer of course is never at the bottom of a bottle, but no, the frustration of watching horses win never left.
You're listening to From the Horse's Mouth by Paddy Power.
Return of the Frank Frank Hickey is back in the hot seat. And how does it feel, Frank? Do you feel like there's been a few young pretenders trying to kind of steal your position? Or are you coming in like a silverback gorilla now trying to kind of stake your claim on the fourth seat of the podcast?
Yeah, I'm more hairy back gorilla, Tom. But I'm not overly false, to be honest. I'm just delighted that there's some racing coming back and we get back to do some real work. Excited for it.
Well, we haven't spoken to you since the Friday at Cheltenham, so it's been a long time coming. But we've got more European racing this weekend. And, of course, Newcastle on Monday. We're waiting for declarations to come out for Newcastle on Monday. Much anticipated, Frank. Not maybe the highest quality, but we've been waiting long enough. We'll take it at this stage.
Oh, yeah, sure. Like, look, I still imagine turnover would be very lively, considering people haven't had domestic racing to bet on. Not the best quality, but the week itself is a cracker. Like, Newmarket at the weekend is going to be excellent. And look, it's just easing us into it slowly, but we've got a great week to look ahead to.
Before we get into the tips, we're going to get a few horses for the tracker. And we're going to break this up over the next 2 weeks. Seeing as we've got you back and your in-depth knowledge of the form book, I'm sure you'll have one or two dark ones to keep an eye out for. Six horses this week for our tracker. You're going to give us three, Frank, and our dynamic duo of Paddy and Ruby are going to give us one each, and I'll chip in with a bad one as well. Frank, do you want to kick us off with three worth sticking in the tracker? And I have to limit you now to a sentence of analysis.
I'll make a kind of a long sentence. So the first one is a horse called Violette Zabo, trained by Nigel Tinkler. He's a trainer very much underestimated, particularly with handicap horses. This horse is by Celebration. Tinkler trained Queso, who was by Celebration as well. Queso started off in handicaps off 56, is now rated 99 a few years later, won its first four handicaps. This horse has shown a bit of ability in its four maiden runs. It's going to start off in handicaps off 69. I would be surprised if this rates a fair bit higher before the season's out. My second horse is Redenza, trained by Mick Halvert. Only had the one start, won a Leopardstown maiden, impressively enough. She's by See the Stars, and she's out of a Group 2 winner called Ray Darris. She's bred to be very useful. And I was just reading there yesterday that she had a small setback. She got injured in that race, but she's back working. The 1,000 guineas, the Irish version, she might need that a small bit, but I think she can make her market group company before the year is out. And my last horse is Rovin' Amy, trained by David Simcock. Cost 320,000 guineas as a yearling. It's related to a horse that was beaten a short head in a Ribblesdale. Went to Linkfield on debut, was absolutely punted off the boards. Travelled like the best horse, got done for experience by a horse called Johan, who's followed up next time. Went to Linkfield on the all-weather for its second start, won very easily. The form has worked out relatively well, and I'd say he could probably win a good handicap before the year's out.
Ruby Walsh, you're one for the tracker.
I'm going to pick out a horse called Boccaccio of Charlie Appleby's. Won twice last year, won first time up in Yarmouth in May, wasn't seen then until Kempton in November, when he absolutely bolted in by 3.5 lengths. He's rated 95, he holds an entry in the Irish 2,000 guineas. I think it's doubtful from talking to William Buick. He's going to turn up there, but I think he's a horse with a big future at the Barbie Colt.
And Paddy Power?
Yeah, I'm going to go for Goshen because I think possibly...
You're still stuck in Cheltenham?
Well, no, but just he was going to hack up on the Triumph and by a mile and looked at a huge, high cruising speed. It's like Overturn, who we were talking about earlier. Could easily gallop some of these flat horse into the ground in big staying handicaps or whatever, because he's a handicap is off 88, I think, which is pretty, looks pretty lenient at this stage. So hopefully, if he does have a bit of a flat campaign, he could be a bit ahead of the handicapper.
And I will throw in, to finish off, Foxtel for Andrew Balding. Not much mileage on the clock. Only got two runs into him as a three-year-old last season. He finished fourth in the Champion Stakes in Ascot and was third in the Criterium de Saint-Cloud as a two-year-old. He could be interesting over longer trips this season. Now, international classic racing this weekend. Frank Hickey, your speciality, of course. Give us one for the From the Horse's Mouth treble to keep an eye on in France or Germany over the weekend.
I'll just put a little disclaimer that I'm definitely not an international expert, but since the two lads are sticking to the French 1,000, 2,000 guineas, I've gone to Cologne for the German 2,000 guineas. And but I'm not an expert in German racing. Rubaiyat, I think, will be favourite. It's only a 7-runner race. He's beaten four of them already, so I think he might be able to beat them again. Rubaiyat and the German 2,000 guineas.
Paddy Power?
Yeah, I'm going to go for the Poule de Say de Pouliche on Monday in France. And I'm going to go for André Fabre and Michael Barcelona with Trobo because it's a horse that was picked out and tipped up by
French. Laurent Barbarin.
Yes, so and it was good enough for him. It got beat. He finished sixth, I think, that in that run. But he's won. Obviously, that was a prep run for Monday. So Trobo in the 1,000 guineas.
And Ruby Walsh.
I'm going to go for Alson for Jean-Pierre Caravallo in the French 2,000 guineas. He was obviously second to Victor Ludorum in the 2-year-old race on Arc Day. He won the two-runner criterium after that in Longchamp when he bolted in beaten Armory 20 lengths, but I don't think that's a reflection of the form. But I thought he was a fair two-year-old, and I think he could step up this year.
Very good. That's our international treble. And lads, I'm going to, when the declarations are out for Newcastle, whenever that seems to be, I don't know, BHA being very all over the place, I don't know, are they late or what's happening, but when the declarations come out, we're going to get a horse each for Newcastle on Monday and stick that up on paddypower.com as an enhanced From the Horse's Mouth treble. Frank, is that okay with you?
Yeah, that's fine.
Thanks for the enthusiasm, Frank. Thanks for joining us.
I'm just looking there, the decks are just through there, and I will give you a winner
for Newcastle. Go on, give us a winner.
135 Mutasami for Roger Varian runs in a handicap of 78. Yeah, it's up against plenty of exposed horses there. This won last time in a handicap at Kempton of 70, very easily beaten Storm Bomber. That was the second handicap start, had been second at Haydock on its handicap debut, beaten a length up £8, but definitely going to rate higher than 78.
We'll let the lads finish up and do a little bit of homework, but we'll get the international treble up on site, enhanced on paddypower.com, and we'll get one each for Newcastle later on. Frank, thanks a million. Thank you very much.
No problem, lads.
Right, that's almost it for today's show. Just enough time for one more stupid question, I think, Paddy.
Yes, this question for Ruby is, what's an extended trip? And it's sent in by Ash D. Cummins.
I think it involves very long trip where you need to check your eyesight and not stop.
Very good, Ruby. Didn't catch out with that one.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is comedy at its most pure. Paddy, Ruby, thanks a million for joining us. Talk to you next week.
Pleasure.
See you, Tom.
See you, Ruby.
See you, Paddy. Good luck.
There you have it. Racing is back in the UK, and we should have the same on this side of the Irish Sea next week. Thanks to our very own Keenan and Kel, Paddy and Ruby. Thanks to William Buick and our great friend Frank Hickey. But most of all, thanks to you for listening. Be sure to check out our enhanced trebles on paddypower.com. But for now, I have been Tom Nugent, and that has been From the Horse's Mouth.
From the Horse's Mouth is a Muddy Knees Media production for Paddy Power.